You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Today's broadcast is in memory of my mother, who taught me to read. Here's the continuation of Conran Country by Mark Rotso, with photographs by Catherine Highland. For his part, Conran calls wasteful consumerism a contemporary evil. It was not what he had in mind in 1964, when various Beatles trooped into Habitat to buy Dieter Rams' hi-fi equipment, or when novelist Kingsley Amis and Elizabeth Jane Howard flirted among the garlic presses and walks. Two more items Conran popularized. Other current design trends alarm him. The collecting mania for Memphis, the 80s postmodern furniture fad, sparked by the Italian designer Ettore Sottsass, leaves Conran in a frost. Sottsass meant it as a joke. It's joke junk. I'm a Bauhaus-educated chap. The proliferation of limited editions by design stars that go for hundreds of thousands of dollars at design fairs, astronomical amounts of money. I'm so much against it. By contrast, when I ask him what he guides his present design sense, his answer was one he could have given at any point over the past 70 years. Economic, plain, simple, and useful. I hope very much in the Shaker tradition. They were my inspiration. Conran admitted he's never visited a New England Shaker village. It's on the bucket list. When I die, I'll be cremated, Conran told me one morning at his London apartment, sitting in an Eames lounger and watching barges lazily making their way down the Thames. In my will, I've left money so that my ashes will be left in rockets for a party to celebrate my demise. I like the idea of being flung into the sky. He intends this to happen at Barton Court. I've always loved pyrotechnics, he said, recounting a boyhood memory of a fireworks party in which an errant rocket ignited a box of recreational ordnance to great alarm and amusement. Conran wasn't interested in offering further insights into mortality or his legacy. When asked about his lasting influence, he barely shrugged. I don't think about it, he said. I just try and get on with the multiple things that I've going on at the moment. Next photo, home improvement. A 24-year-old Conran in London in 1956, the year he started his design practice. And in the photo, he sits in one of his famous tripod chairs, dressed in a suit, looking very dashing. Perhaps the clearest embodiment of Conran's impact on the culture will be the $103 million Design Museum, which now resides in a modernist landmark building in Kensington, with a distinctive vaulted roof, restored by the Dutch firm Oma, and elegantly minimal interiors by John Pawson. I'm absolutely thrilled with it, Conran exclaimed when we toured the space. He has called the complex, which opened in 2016, his single most rewarding achievement. The upward trajectory of the museum, as it has relocated over the years from a basement at the Victoria and Albert Museum to a derelict banana warehouse to its current spiffy digs, suggests something about the rising status of design in contemporary culture and about Conran's role in making it so. For Terence, the Design Museum is all about giving something back to Britain, Diane Sudjic, the Design Museum's director told me as we spun through the airy galleries. Ambra Mehta, a museum trustee and co-founder of Design Miami, said, "Terrence cares about longevity and quality. He's looking way beyond his own empire." Through its exhibitions and educational outreach, the museum will continue Conran's mentorship into perpetuity. At the building's entrance, Conran paused under a white sign that read, "The Design Museum was founded by Sir Terence Conran in 1989 in the belief that design has a vital part to play in shaping and understanding the world." A tan leather briefcase, which looked very full, rested at his feet. "I was about to remark on this tableau, the man, the museum, and the mission, when Conran preemptively offered a handshake and a farewell. 'I'm afraid I must go now,' he said, leaning into his cane and turning toward the waiting car that would speed him back to Barton Court. 'I really have a hell of a lot of work to do.'" Mad About Barry by Evgenia Peretz. Opening photograph by Martin Scheller. Styled by Nicole Chapoteau. Barry Weiss, photographed in New York City, wearing a trench coat by Max Mara, dress by Valentino, shoes by Manolo Blahnik, hair products by Uribe, makeup by Dior, beauty nail enamel by Chanel. And she's walking down an older street, some cobblestones exposed, and it's very windy. Star New York Times writer Barry Weiss is a woman Twitter loves to hate. So how did the liberal, Trump-loathing theater nerd become a lightning rod for the left? Meet Barry Weiss, alt-writer, fascist, the Jewish female version of Kanye West. She doesn't like immigrants. She's a traitor to her gender, and she should be sterilized. In short, Barry Weiss can F off. That's the word, anyway, about the 35-year-old star opinion writer for the New York Times from a very loud and increasingly influential corner of social media. Her newfound fame has transcended her platform. She's become a somewhat unwitting avatar for the knee-jerk flashbang of social media, a poster child for the polarization of the chattering classes. Therefore, it's disorienting to meet Weiss and discover that she's neither an aspiring sex symbol, bomb thrower, a la Ann Coulter, nor a defensive Ivy League know-it-all. When she walks into Café Luxembourg on the Upper West Side, blocks from her fifth-floor walk-up, you might peg her as a kindergarten teacher. She's petite, with hair parted down the middle and pulled back in a low ponytail, big glasses framing a cherubic face. She's effusive and warm, immediately popping out with one eager question after another before I can successfully steer the conversation around to her. Her minor insecurities are blurted fodder for making a connection. I have pin marks on my boob. I was like, I'm going to meet a Vanity Fair writer and I have pin on my boob. I was really embarrassed. Also, I've been sweating a lot. She says that her father has been urging her to freeze her eggs. Should I do it now? She asks, sincerely searching for an answer. This isn't some dopey act intended to charm. Weiss seems genuinely fueled by curiosity, the desire to connect, to cross boundaries, and to try out new things. As she sums up her outlook, I just want to gobble the world. Though most of her friends are liberals, she sometimes socializes with conservatives, too. According to friends, she loves to spar not just to hear the sound of her own voice, but because she might learn something. After listening to someone else's point of view, she's been known to do something amazing, change her mind. Given the current climate, in which everyone seems to be retreating to angry and angrier corners, those who meet her find this expansiveness refreshing. Jennifer Senior, an op-ed columnist for The Times, disagreed with some of Weiss's political opinions, such as her pro-Israel stance, but was curious about this new co-worker, who was, as Senior puts it, steering the aircraft into a cloud of flak. So Senior introduced herself. She was so adorable, I wanted to wrap her up in tissue paper and take her home with me. Young writers such as Teriro Mizuzawa, who've worked under Weiss in her capacity as editor, attest that she's consistently enthusiastic about ideas she may disagree with, even nurturing. She was the first person to put in my head that I could write an op-ed, says the Zimbabwe-born writer. Today, Senior says, I always marvel at the huge gulf between the Barry, who's this Twitter bogeyman, and Barry, the actual person. She is the subject of more unexamined hatred in our profession than almost anyone I can think of. She's the target of so much snark. The irony, and what almost breaks my heart, is that she has almost no snark in her. She's super generous and loving. For people of a certain age, it might seem odd that Weiss should be a favorite punching bag for lefties with itchy Twitter fingers. If you read her work, she's a liberal humanist whose guiding principle is free expression in art, love, and discourse, something the left spent decades fighting to achieve. Some of Weiss's articles have been harshly but fairly criticized with basic civility by prominent journalists such as Rebecca Traister and Glenn Greenwald. But Twitter is something else. There lives a non-negotiable doctrine in which there's only good opinion and bad opinion. Anyone who strays must be called out. But called out is too gentle a term. The targets must be taken down, not just hated, but hated on. And the trolls aren't random. Some have platforms beyond Twitter, including HuffPost, Esquire, and lefty news sites. For writers hoping to gain a following, slamming Barry Weiss has become an easy way to be seen. It wouldn't matter if she were writing for the Wall Street Journal. The problem, or opportunity really, is that she's writing for the New York Times, which is supposed to be their paper, and that she's getting famous for it. Broadly speaking, Weiss's work is heterodox, defying easy us-them-left-right categorization. Since getting hired at the paper in the spring of 2017, she has focused on hot-button cultural topics, such as hashtag MeToo, the Women's March, and campus activism, approaching each topic with a confrontational skepticism that until recently had a strong place within the liberal discourse. Her basic gist, while such movements are well-intentioned, their excesses of zeal, often imposed by the hard left, can backfire. Take one of her early pieces, an August 2017 column on the Women's March. "The march moved me," Weiss wrote, "and was an important response to Trump's attacking the weakest and most vulnerable in our society." Yet she was disturbed that two of the four leaders of the march had recent histories of praising known anti-Semite Louis Farrakhan. Weiss's view turned out to be prescient, and the march has since splintered into factions. Weiss has approached hashtag MeToo with attention to the gray areas. A piece called "The Limits of Believe All Women" praised those who started hashtag MeToo, but cautioned that if we believe women in every instance, it could result in a doozy of a mistake and harm the overarching movement. On the subject of Stephen Elliott, a writer who was suing the creator of the shitty Media Men list, where he was anonymously accused of rape, Weiss was sympathetic to his predicament, but warned that his lawsuit could be used to stifle women's speech. Next photo, Bill Maher and Weiss discussed the hashtag MeToo movement on Real Time with Bill Maher last year. In a more reported piece, Weiss addressed Australian actress Yael Stone's accusations against Jeffrey Rush. She came down on the side of the accuser and highlighted the difficulty of publicly calling out bad behavior in Australia, where Rush and Stone are both from, due to libel laws. Rush has denied the allegations and recently won a defamation suit against an Australian publisher. Though Weiss did not devote a column to Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh, she wondered aloud on MSNBC if his alleged crime as a teenager should be disqualifying. Weiss was promptly smacked down in headlines and admits that her soundbites came across as glib and simplistic. For the record, she says Ford's testimony moved her to tears and believes Kavanaugh's rage-filled behavior before the Senate Judiciary Committee should have disqualified him. Weiss has little patience for the new campus activism, in which she says students have been blithely tarring professors as fascist. In a May 2018 feature, Meet the Renegades of the Intellectual Dark Web, Weiss profiled several popular academics and pundits, such as Brett Weinstein, Jordan Peterson, and Christina Hoff Sommers, who've retreated from academia and the mainstream media but have emerged on other platforms. Some thought the piece was a frank portrait of a phenomenon worthy of examination. Others believed that by giving these provocateurs the floor, Weiss was endorsing their opinions. Weiss views outcries over cultural appropriation, Katy Perry shouldn't wear a kimono, Marc Jacobs shouldn't put white models in dreadlocks, and so on, as un-American. If that point of view wins, it's just a pleasureless gray world, she says. Who wants to live in a world where you can only stay in the lane of your birth? Literally everything good about this culture comes from mixing. The day after Weiss wrote, "Three Cheers for Cultural Appropriation," Greenwald published a full-throated takedown of a range of her opinions, calling her writing trite, shallow, cheap. He also accused Weiss of crusading against Arabs, Muslims, and other assorted critics of Israel. It's here where Weiss's views draw the most passionate objections. She is an ardent Zionist and has come to believe that much of the anti-Zionist talk on the left is tantamount to anti-Semitism, a view that many American Jews find objectionable and even infuriating. But her passion for Israel has not defined her overarching belief system, the need to protect what makes America great. And in this, she believes it's right-wing American Jews who have lost their way. After the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Squirrel Hill, Pittsburgh, where Weiss grew up, she appeared on Real Time with Bill Maher and issued a warning to American Jews who aligned themselves with Trump because they like his policies. I hope this week that American Jews have woken up to the price of that bargain. They have traded policies that they like for the values that have sustained the Jewish people and, frankly, this country for forever. Welcoming the stranger, dignity for all human beings, equality under the law, respect for dissent, love of truth. These are the things that we're losing under this president, and no policy is worth that price. So that's her take on Trump. If she wanted to, Weiss could criticize him in every one of her articles. But, she asks, is our job to be a warm bath in an ideological safe space for people who we think are our readers? Or is it our job to show them the scope of opinions, legitimate opinions, that people all over this country have? I think that's our job. But there are other people out there who apparently think the job of a newspaper is almost to be socialist realist art. In Squirrel Hill, the Menchie, salt-of-the-earth Jewish community in which Weiss, the oldest of four sisters, grew up, opposing viewpoints were able to exist in harmony. Her father, Lou, a successful carpet salesman, is conservative. He has contributed op-eds to the journal himself. Her mother, Amy, who worked as a makeup buyer for Kaufman's department store before joining Lou at the family company, is a liberal. They ate bacon and went to synagogue only on Yom Kippur. But as Weiss says, Shabbat dinner was not to be missed. It was a busy household with neighbors coming in and out. Passionate disagreements on the Clinton impeachment, or whatever issue du jour, were a constant, and Weiss relished these debates. Intellectual strivers and do-gooders, Lou and Amy made Weiss keep journals and would pay her $5 to read a book and write a report. If she did something wrong, her punishment was to write a lengthy letter of apology and hand-deliver it to whomever was offended. At her traditional high school, where freshman girls were giving guys blowjobs in their ski houses, Weiss says she felt excruciatingly nerdy and alienated, though she was student council president. After high school, she took a gap year in Israel, becoming, or so she felt, a progressive feminist Zionist. She worked in the Negev Desert, helping to build a medical clinic for Bedouin, and studied at a feminist yeshiva and Hebrew university, where she took to musical theater. She came back to the States to attend Columbia, where she met and fell in love with a woman. Not just any woman, but a wry fellow student named Kate McKinnon, who's now Saturday Night Live's premier star, thanks to her spot-on impersonations of half the Beltway class, Hillary Clinton, Jeff Sessions, Kellyanne Conway, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Mika Brzezinski, Nancy Pelosi, and more. They were on and off for several years and remain good friends. Beyond that, Weiss won't give details. I've been in love with both men and women. I've been ghosted by both men and women. But, she says, I don't trade on my sexual identity in that way for political points. I think that's lame, and it's not my style. Weiss had entered college as a theater nerd, but found herself, quite by accident, in the role of activist, writer, and lightning rod. She was taking classes in the Middle East department, which was largely populated, she says, by anti-Zionist professors who were using their classrooms as a bully pulpit to promote their views, which they were entitled to do. But there were instances that she felt crossed the line, such as the time a student who had served in the Israeli military allegedly asked a question of Professor Joseph Mossad, and Mossad replied, "Before I answer your question, tell the group how many Palestinians you've killed." Mossad has denied saying this. Weiss, along with a handful of other students, believed this kind of alleged behavior amounted to intimidation. They formed a group called Columbians for Academic Freedom, and Weiss began writing in the student paper, the Columbia Spectator, arguing that students had a right to express their views without fear of punishment or intimidation by their teachers. Fellow students struck back, charging that Weiss and her classmates were McCarthyites out to silence professors. Indeed, some of Weiss's current critics point to her history as evidence of hypocrisy, given her sharp stance against current student activism. Weiss insists her views are consistent and come down to one fundamental principle: I hate bullies. In college, I protested bullying professors who used their classrooms to promote propaganda and to silence opposing views. Now I criticize bullying students who are succeeding in driving out, or at the very least, putting a bold question mark over the names of good people like Brett Weinstein and Nicholas Christakis. Still, as her future friend Jennifer Senior wrote at the time of the Columbia controversy, in New York Magazine, intimidation is a subjective notion, a devil without contours. What one student finds intimidating, another may find provocative, even intoxicating. Post-college, Weiss went to work for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz and the Jewish newspaper The Forward. In 2007, at age 23, she got a job at the Wall Street Journal as a baby op-ed editor, did a 2-year stint as an editor at the online Jewish magazine Tablet, and then returned to the Journal in 2013 as editor of the Book Review. Around the same time, she got married to an environmental engineer about whom she says he's a wonderful person, and I think the world of him. Weiss might have stayed in the books section at the Journal, but Trump's candidacy woke her up to her real passion, the intersection of politics and culture. She realized that she was one of the most left-wing people at the paper, a situation that became constraining. During the campaign, she tried to sound the alarm about Steve Bannon, but was told that she didn't have the standing. She wanted to write about Melania Trump's hypocrisy with her cyberbullying issue, but wasn't allowed to. Barry wrote many fine pieces for the Journal, and I don't want to comment on work that wasn't up to her usual standard, then acting op-ed editor Melanie Kirkpatrick says, referring to those proposed topics. On the morning after Trump won, I was sobbing openly at my desk. I wanted people to see how I felt about this and what I thought it meant for the country. I realized I had to leave. Her personal life had become frayed and disorienting, too. As much as she adored her husband, she realized that we just operated on different speeds, and they split up. In April 2017, Weiss got an offer to work as both a staff editor and writer for the Times opinion section under James Bennett, who was looking to expand the spectrum of ideas. As an editor, she assigned Vanity Fair contributor Monica Lewinsky a piece about Roger Ailes and Fox News' toxic environment. And she commissioned a piece by Rachel Denhollander, the first woman to publicly accuse Olympics gymnastics team doctor Larry Nassar of sexual abuse. While those articles fit comfortably into the Times progressive zone, her own did not. And Aziz Ansari is guilty of not being a mind reader. She took on the Babe.net story in which an anonymous woman accused Aziz Ansari of sexual misconduct because he didn't respond to her nonverbal cues during their date. Weiss charged that Grace had every opportunity to walk out and that her story denied women agency. Some feminists weren't pleased with Weiss's take. Gabriella Cameron, an editor at UCLA's feminist news magazine, Femme, tweeted, "Hey, Barry, please do feminism and the entire profession of journalism a favor and stop writing." But Weiss had hit a nerve, including among Times readers. To them and to some prominent feminist writers, Weiss was expressing a valid and growing fear about the movement's overreach, a fear some were reluctant to state in public. It was around this time Bill Maher took notice of Weiss, finding in her a kindred spirit in an increasingly lonely camp. "We're trying to get liberal back into liberalism," he says. The two had never met before she appeared on his show in February 2018 to discuss hashtag MeToo, but their interchange had an affectionate familiarity. With all the talk about pain and sexual violation, Weiss asked, "Whatever happened to intimacy and love and romance?" Fellow guest April Ryan, White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks, chimed in, "I want to be courted. Courted, but with boundaries," she added. "Weiss was a hit," says Maher. "I always say she's my new star. The public has taken notice." Indeed, as Weiss and I discuss her appearance on Maher, we are approached by a middle-aged couple who've been eavesdropping. "All right, I have to interrupt," says the woman. "We did see you on Maher. I loved you." Her husband adds, "For our generation, it's important that there's a voice like yours." Weiss tells them that they've made her day and gets their stories. They're from the Upper West Side, but now live in Vermont, near Burlington. "It's Bernie country," the woman explains. "You Bernie people?" Weiss asks. "Of course." But Weiss's growing visibility was galling to the hard-left Twitter sphere. On February of last year, Weiss gave them an opportunity to show it. After Japanese-American ice skater Mirai Nagasu landed a triple axel, Weiss tweeted out a video of Nagasu along with the caption, "Immigrants, they get the job done," referencing a line from Hamilton. Nagasu, though a child of immigrants, was born in California. When this was pointed out on Twitter, Weiss tweeted back, "Yes, yes, I realize. Felt the poetic license was kosher." Well, it wasn't kosher. She was called a racist for the tweet. She also got the pronoun and the lyric wrong. "It's immigrants, we get the job done, not they." "You othered a U.S. citizen because she is not Caucasian," tweeted someone. Weiss says she meant to celebrate both the skater and the idea of immigrants. But this was a good moment for a pile-on. Barry Weiss is a professional bad opinion haver. Fitting that her last name is Weiss, etc. The magnitude of her crime ballooned into her own workplace. A handful of staffers at the New York Times took to their group chat Slack channel to complain about Weiss. That tweet denied Mirai her full citizenship, just as the internment did, wrote one staffer, who believed the tweet constituted one more microaggression within the New York Times. A transcript of the conversation was given to HuffPost, which posted it on the site under the headline "Leaked Chat Transcripts, New York Times Employees Are Pissed About Barry Weiss." Weiss tries to be sanguine about the nature of Twitter. "There's nothing to do other than push forward and prove to people by the way you are in the world and your behavior and what you write, your character, and who you are," she says. But the messaging among her colleagues was different. "I could sit here and tell you that didn't hurt me. But of course it did hurt me. The amazing thing is, not one of those colleagues wrote me an email or said, 'I disagreed with your tweet about your article. Want to have coffee and talk about it?'" Bennett, her boss, attests that anybody who knows Barry realizes what a generous colleague she is and what an openness she herself brings to these conversations. Last May, fresh horror was unleashed on Twitter when a random tweeter revealed Weiss used to date McKinnon, a certified cool person. "It's very unsettling," tweeted Brandy Jensen, an editor at The Outline. Andy Zeisler, co-founder of Bitch Media, offered some soothing words. Following up to emphasize that, as unsettling as this might be, who among us has not made extremely questionable dating choices at one time or another? More wrong people started following for her, like Times reporter Nellie Bowles, a left-wing former Vice News correspondent who began posting photos of them together on Instagram. "They've been dating for a year." Bowles herself wrote the definitive takedown of Jordan Peterson just 10 days after he featured in Weiss's intellectual dark web story. Along with Marr came other famous liberal fans, including writer and LGBTQ activist Dan Savage, who has become a friend. "With someone like Barry, someone people on my side drag to virtue signal, there's a temptation to cover your butt with, 'Now, I don't agree with everything she writes,'" he says. "But really, who couldn't you say that about? I sometimes read stuff I wrote 10 years ago or 10 months ago that I don't agree with anymore." Barry does good and interesting work, and she's a kind and lovely person. If liking Barry makes me a bad lefty, well, so be it. "It's maddening for her critics," says her friend Alana Newhouse, editor of Tablet. "They would love for somebody who doesn't share their politics to seem musty and unsexy." With every new career development, the attacks come. In August, when the New York Times announced it would send Weiss to Australia as part of an effort to expand readership, Yeet Heer of the New Republic tweeted, "The prospect of Barry Weiss in Australia is, frankly, terrifying." A few weeks later, when the New Yorker decided to rescind its invitation to Steve Bannon to participate in the magazine's festival, after readers and staffers protested, New Yorker food correspondent and frequent Weiss critic Helen Rosner tweeted, "Somewhere in Australia, Barry Weiss's delicately filigreed Hebrew nameplate necklace just started pulsing a pure white light against her clavicle," a reference to Batman. When Weiss announced she would write a book about the need to recover a civic culture, "As if we haven't suffered enough, Barry Weiss got a book deal," went the headline on the website splinternews.com. Weiss's first book, How to Fight Anti-Semitism, comes out in September. "The animating energy right now in the culture is destruction," says Weiss. "The casual dehumanization from the left and the right is so appalling to me." Bennett shares the concern. "It's just a crazy, terrible environment right now," he says, noting that one of his writers was recently verbally accosted and another, a left-leaning one, received a death threat. In December, Weiss and Eve Pacer, a young social media dynamo and progressive writer at Vice, wrote a Times column together, examining all the hate. The two women met at the Aspen Ideas Festival last summer. They had been aware of each other from social media and regarded each other with mutual distaste. "I used to watch her Twitter feed in terror that she was going to come after me," says Weiss. "Hating Barry was the natural position for me to adopt," Pacer wrote. Neither of them knew many people at the conference and so decided to hang out. They talked and talked about religion, their childhoods, the pernicious nature of social media, and lo and behold, became friends. Pacer was genuinely terrified to tell this rather innocuous story of female friendship, a measure of the hard left's power to intimidate. She recalls, "I couldn't sleep because I knew people would flip out at me and call me a bad person." Indeed, Pacer got a beating. Among the many angry tweets the piece received were these from Rosner. "It's vanishingly rare that anyone is a full-on oozing shithead one-on-one." And, "I like Eve. I think I understand what she thought she was doing." It makes me so sad. I'm usually pretty appalled by the perspective and issues that Barry has decided to use her considerable platform to amplify, Rosner wrote to me in an email. Even more, I find her apparent bafflement at being joked about and criticized, even as she has made her profession out of diminishing and criticizing people with whom she disagrees, to be cut from the same flimsy moral fabric as her public opinions. Weiss is still trying to have a discourse without sacrificing her views. In a January column about Ilhan Omar, one of the first Muslim women elected to Congress, and lately the target of Islamophobic attacks from the president, Weiss raised alarm about a tweet of Omar's from 2012. "Israel has hypnotized the world," pointing out that her word choice was classic anti-Semitic rhetoric. Without retracting her criticism of Israel, Omar sincerely apologized for her language and replied to Weiss that she had learned that my use of the word hypnotize and the ugly sentiment it holds was offensive. Weiss thanked her and invited her into the Times office to share her views with editors. And what of the snark-happy would-be journalist of Generation Y? As it happens, Gabriella Cameron, the UCLA student who had tweeted that Barry Weiss should do feminism and the entire profession of journalism a favor and stop writing, revised her view about Weiss after a synagogue meeting last spring. That tweet epitomizes everything that is wrong with Twitter, Cameron told me. I was partially motivated by the desire for likes and retweets, wanting to cultivate a brand on Twitter. It was at Barry's expense, knowing that she, like me, is a complex person. From writer A.M. Holmes comes this, In Memoriam, Everlasting Light, with photograph by Michaeline Thomas. Technicolor talent, Barbara Hammer, photographed in Brooklyn on December 20th, 2018. And in the photo, Barbara Hammer sits on a multi-printed sofa, and the clothing she is wearing is by Marc Jacobs and is extremely multicolored. Technicolor, indeed. Barbara Hammer was ebullient even as she was dying. After 5 decades as a cult figure in the art world and a fearless icon in the LGBTQ community, The experimental filmmaker spent her final years demonstrating that the art of death and the art of life are one and the same. The camera becomes part of my body when I am letting it express how my movement feels, how my sight lines change direction, how passionate I am about texture and the body, Hammer told me a few months before her death in March. She only recently entered the global consciousness. In her last years, she put on a retrospective at the Leslie Lohman Museum of Gay and Lesbian Art in New York City. At the Whitney, she performed a spoken meditation on living with advanced cancer, and her work will appear at the Biennale this month. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is restoring more than 80 of her films, including her groundbreaking and inescapably explicit Tactics, 1974, the first lesbian erotic film made by a lesbian. There is a filmmaking grant in her name, and her archives have been deposited at Yale's Beinecke Library. This month, her work is being shown at Houston's Contemporary Arts Museum, and in June, Ohio's Wexner Center for the Arts opens Barbara Hammer in This Body, an exhibition centered around evidentiary bodies, Hammer's first multi-channel, multi-screen video installation highlighting her intimate exploration of the female form. Her conceptual sophistication pushed the boundaries of celluloid while asking big questions about who makes history and who is left out. What the new queer cinema era took from works by experimental queer filmmakers like Barbara, says Paris's Burning filmmaker Jenny Livingston, is a sense that people who have experiences that are different from other people's, as queer people do, may, in fact, want to tell stories differently. Born in Hollywood in 1939, Hammer grew up in the West, married a man, and began studying painting before coming out. "I was a painter before a filmmaker," she said. "I was a poet before a painter. I was an infant adoring the world from my little reign in a baby pen in the backyard of a working-class Inglewood neighborhood. Everything is important." This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.